This is part four of the four-hour lecture series called Hale Bopp Harrington, Art Bell, Coast to Coast AM, and Planet 10 Update. Never in the history of man has a topic so stirred the interest of everyone that has heard the term, and never in the history of man has there been more effort to subvert the truth on a given topic, and of course that topic deals with Planet X. It is as if it strikes fear into the hearts of all, like the smell of man and a fond deer. Something is written in our DNA that stirs our fight or flight instincts. Adrenaline rushes to the brain. Dreams occur. All other topics pale in its presence. Everyone seems to just drop what they were doing, but it seems that those who fear it most are the world leaders. Their yellow brick road to their emerald city has a frail curtain that hides their utmost fear that the public would, in mass, would one day wake up and realize that their omnipotence does not cover Planet X. Comets are the key to the entire issue. So all of the distorted information that's thrown at you, the public. Here I'm going to be concentrating primarily on the planets of the solar system. Just first I'm going to mention that recently astronomers discovered a huge comet in another solar system. It's literally almost a Jupiter-sized planet orbiting around a star. And what they noticed was a vast comet tail associated with this planet. And, of course, what I have been saying all along is that comets and planets really are one and the same. And even if you look at Earth today, we have a comet tail. Jupiter, all the planets are discharging the solar capacitor. We all have comet tails. Pluto is acting more than any like a comet. That's been announced, something I predicted all along because I knew it was out there on the edge of the Kuiper Belt, which is on the edge of that nebular ion cloud that surrounds all of the fusion stars. But let me jump into little Mercury. Mercury has an eccentricity of 0.2, which means that it is far from a circular orbit. It also has an inclination of 7 degrees from the ecliptic, which is the plane which most of the planets are very, very close to the ecliptic. Earth's orbit is actually defined as the ecliptic. But Mercury has an inclination of 7 degrees and is highly elliptical. So how does this happen? Well, let's just take a look at the long-term effect here. There's two major dominant effects in the solar system. One is Jupiter. Jupiter is a major factor dominant in the solar system. And if I were going to choose a point of reference for the entire solar system, it would be Jupiter, not Earth, and show that Earth is a little bit off of the plane of the planet, so to speak, or if you were celestial mechanically correct in terms of actual physics, you would take the average of all of the planets and put them in and determine what that plane, in other words, the plane of rotational momentum, angular momentum, and you would, that's the position or the plane that you would use to define the plane of the planets, but of course that would be changing all the time as new members came in, etc. And of course we don't have a good measure on all the asteroids. They would actually add up to a total contribution. But Mercury, let's take a look at what happens to an object that moves above the plane of Jupiter's orbit. It's the Sun and Jupiter both are going to pull down as well as pull towards the bodies. The vector that is out of the plane of the planets is pulling down on that object. When the object goes below the solar system, the Sun and Jupiter are pulling up on it. So over a period of time, and you can actually calculate this amount of time, and it's not very long at all in terms of solar system life of the age of the solar system, all planets that are in prograde orbits, that is, they're moving in the same direction as Earth and the other planets, all of them should be pulled into the plane of the planets. They're constantly working to pull. Earth and Jupiter are constantly pulling, and so if Jupiter pulls up on Earth to bring it into alignment with Jupiter's orbit, then Earth pulls down on Jupiter. So they're constantly adjusting. But the end result is that all of the planets, within a relatively short amount of time astronomically, should lie in the same plane. Well, why doesn't Mercury? Mercury seems to be a very old planet. It's been around for a long time, supposedly. Well, it's the innermost planet in the solar system, allegedly protected by all the other planets. So what could get near little Mercury to cause it to change its orbit to be highly eccentric and also off of the inclination as much as 7 degrees off the rest of the planets? Well, probably what happened is a large comet came in near Mercury, tossed it around a little bit, and changed its orbit. Very simple. So Mercury, right off the bat, does not fit the standard solar system model of all of these objects forming from a rotating dust cloud. And oddly enough, Mercury owns most of the angular momentum of the solar system. If you understand what angular momentum is, it's a physics term. If you understand what that means, it's odd that including the rotational angular momentum of the sun and all the other planets, including Jupiter, Mercury contains most of the angular momentum. It's a very interesting little piece of information. But the end result is that Mercury should have a perfectly circular orbit, especially being close to the sun. The other issue is that the sun has a central bulge at its equator. It's a little bit more round at the equator than more radius at the equator than it is in the polar direction. And so that also would tend to pull Mercury into the plane, and especially over a long period of time. Venus is a full 3 degrees off the ecliptic, indicating to me that Venus is a new planet. By the way, Venus has a resonance, a surface resonance with the planet Earth. And this is something, it's rather complicated, so I'm not going to rehash this during this particular show. I'll probably do that maybe as an entire radio show someday. But Venus has a surface resonant lock with Earth, in that every certain number of revolutions, Venus shows the same side to Earth on a periodic basis, which indicates that one time they had a gravitational lock. These gravitational locks do not last very long, so that means it must have been recent. And, of course, standard astronomy cannot explain this, nor can they explain why Venus, which allegedly they say is an old planet, why it would be 3 degrees off the ecliptic. But at any rate, another indication that Venus is a young planet. It exhibits also a comet tail, something that NASA finally came out and admitted publicly when they admitted that Pluto had a comet tail. Then they said, well, Venus and Mars also do, if you come right down to it, all the planets are discharging the solar capacitor. They all exhibit tails. And something I've been saying for years is that Venus has been acting much like a comet. In fact, it's been known since the Middle Ages, since around 1200. The Chinese noted that the swine flu, the chicken and swine flu, are commensurate with the inferior conjunction of Venus, which means Venus is between us and the sun. That's because, as I've explained, Venus does sport a comet tail, and in that comet tail are viruses built up from, just like we've discovered now on the comet 67P with the Rosetta space mission landing on it, covered with dust, made primarily of hydrogen, carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen, the basic building blocks of life and the basic building blocks of viruses. So that's why when we pass through that tail of Venus, we have a surge in flu epidemics, because the viruses come in, what we call flu. Pluto, I'll jump out to Pluto right now, confirmed to be a new comet. A comet has comet tail, comet properties, just like I predicted. Its orbit, very eccentric, and out of the inclination is out of the plane of the ecliptic. Either it's very recent, or it had a drastically has been affected by some other large passing planet X type object. And this is my point in talking about all of this, is that none of the planets really fit this image of being formed all at one time, or that they formed all at one time and nothing has happened since. It simply isn't the case. If you look at the planets and really look at them, even the cursory examination, they do not fit the concept that they all formed at one time. Also, I mentioned before that comets come in various sizes. Small would be Halley's comet. Medium would be Hale-Bopp. Large would be like Venus, the comet Venus, which eventually became the planet Venus. And then the super big ones, of which we don't really have a historical record, thank goodness, because they're going to really label everything in the solar system if they come through, having effects on everything, possibly to some degree. So those are very rare, and in terms of statistically rare objects or the occurrence of these, the small comets, there are many, many. Medium-sized comets like Hale-Bopp, there are a few. Of the large comets like Venus, very few. And of the super big comets like something the size of Jupiter, nucleus the size of Jupiter or larger, very, very few. So thank goodness for that, that most of the comets are small. But astronomers take the venue that all comets are small, which is totally incorrect. So on to the asteroids. I've already talked about this, that Vesta and the other asteroids, spectroscopically, they're piecing them back together to show that they were a larger object, 67P, the comet visited by the Rosetta spacecraft. As the lander, the Rosetta Philae, the lander, rotated in towards the comet nucleus, it took very close up, very close range photographs of the comet nucleus, striated rock coming out of the outcropping of rock coming out of the nucleus, showing that this comet nucleus was once part of a water planet where the striated layers were layered down in water. Or it could have been something like, say, Titan, which has a methane atmosphere and it actually rains methane, or potentially an atmosphere like Venus, which is sulfuric acid raining out of the sky instead of water. But be that as it may, layered rock is an indication, striated rock is an indication of layering, which is due to a repeated type of geological surface structure, usually typically related to water. And so indicating that, in fact, many of the objects in the asteroid belt are related to, they were developed inside of a planetary core. Then eventually this thing was blown to smithereens by a contact with another object, a big celestial object, and resulting in all of these scattered pieces in the asteroid belt, not to mention many of them are captured and possibly from collisions in other completely other solar systems. Mars recently had oceans. I've talked about this, extensive coverage on this on my webpage. NASA was had one option, was to come out and publicly state exactly what I'd been stating, that Mars had oceans. In fact, in the last year, probably 30 of my major predictions have come true, and the only recourse that NASA has had is to come out and actually announce it and try and take credit for it. That's how bad it's getting out there. The NASA boys are running scared because I'm hitting them, beating them to the punch on every count. Mars was a blue planet, and so it lost its oceans recently because you don't see cratering in the oceans, etc. And this is another thing that you find with going back to Pluto, extremely young surface. Also Charon, the moon, the primary moon of Pluto, is showing very young surface structure, showing that it's a very recent developed planet. And it's the farthest one out in the solar system. How do these things happen? That's because it's a comet. It's acting like a comet, still in the stage of development. Earth, two known events, the Noah event, the Great Flood, also the Moses event, which I also talk about as the Venus event, in which the Mayans assure us that occurred on two occasions, the comet Venus came by, which they call Quetzalcoatl, came by Earth on two separate occasions, 54 years apart. Then also look at our moon. Oh, my goodness. Our moon is 6.5 degrees off of the ecliptic. And, of course, Earth's angle is 23.5 degrees with the ecliptic. So clearly our moon had an experience, let's put it that way, because if our moon had this orbit over a long period of time astronomically, it would have been pulled into the plane of the planets by the same process that I described originally. Jupiter and Earth, in fact, would pull down on it when it's above the ecliptic, and the Sun, all of these would be pulling down on them in concert. And so over astronomically long period of time, all of the moons should become aligned with the ecliptic, just like Jupiter's moons are in the ecliptic, because they're very old. But Earth's moon is not. At any rate, how Venus became a planet, it was a large comet. It was captured by Jupiter, spent, I estimate, about 600 years winding its way through the solar system, encountered Mars on at least one occasion, ripped the oceans and atmosphere off of Mars when it came by Earth. Gravitational surface gravity of Venus, the comet nucleus, was less than that of Earth, so Earth won the tug of war. I talk about this all the time on my radio show, in my books. And so Earth had a giant pollution event, which is recorded in history. Other great comets, Hale-Bopp literally is the record-breaker comet for all of the comets we have record of. The great comets of the Middle Ages lasted possibly a week. Hale-Bopp was 18 months visible to the naked eye, 6 years visible with minor telescopic or optical equipment, and still visible with good telescopic equipment. So Hale-Bopp breaking all kinds of records, being seen by the most number of people, and literally is the newest celestial member of our solar system becoming a planet, now on a 2,600-year orbit. The statistics of solar system formation, it's something I talk about in my Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes books, a book that the statistics, now, if you look at the statistical average, if you took all of the objects in the solar system from the finest dust particle up to Jupiter, and then the Sun, of course, is bigger, but if you took all the planetary type objects, the minor stars, Jupiter, Saturn, the other planets, and you put them kind of in a, kind of a size category, there's one the size of Jupiter, Saturn is a bit smaller, Uranus and Neptune are in the kind of the same league, Earth, Venus, Mars, and actually Pluto, Earth, and Mercury kind of in the same group, so you've got about five or six of those. Then you go down to the minor planets, there's probably 20 or 30 of those. That includes Charon, the moon of Pluto, and Vesta, and Ceres, the minor planet that was just visited by a spacecraft. Then you go down to the asteroids, there's thousands and thousands of asteroids. You go down to smaller particles, there's millions of those. Statistically, there are not many big objects in the solar system, and that reflects the statistical average out there in outer space in general. There's a lot of small stuff. There's not so much medium small stuff. There's even less medium, you know, and as you get to larger objects, there is less and less of the larger objects. So that does not mean they're impossible to locate. It just means they're more rare. So the majority of comets that we see in the solar system are small. That doesn't mean they're all small. And so that's one of the greatest myths of all astronomy, is that comets are small, little snowballs. And in my work, I'll repeat this now just for completeness, I talk about what I call the axioms of astronomy. This term was actually written to me by a professor in England who was refereeing my papers when I was on the faculty at Cornell University, 1979, and I was submitting my papers, and he's getting heat for publishing my papers in a journal in the Netherlands. of Astrophysics Space Science Journal. And he writes to me and he says, you know, from what's going on here, one would have to consider astronomy as a religion, and or at best that it is axiomatic. In other words, that astronomy has certain axioms, almost like mathematics, that you have to begin with. And if you don't use those axioms, you can't be in the ballpark. And so I developed what I call the axioms of astronomy. That would be that that comets are dirty snowballs. That's one of the incorrect axioms of astronomy. That space is electrically neutral. That's an incorrect assumption or axiom of astronomy. That the planets formed all at one time 4.5 billion years ago, another incorrect axiom of astronomy. And that the universe is expanding, in other words, the redshift is due to the expansion of the universe. And what I've shown there also is that it's due to the induced electric dipole redshift, the theory that I developed for redshift due to photons moving in a non-uniform electric field, which is laboratory proven. I mean, you're able to set this up in experiments in the laboratory and actually prove it, and then apply it to astronomy. But, of course, the politics of astronomy, astrophysics, etc. is too great, and nobody wants to talk about this because the whole house of cards would come tumbling down. Okay, so let's go out to Mars. I talked about Mars being a planet, used to be a water planet, now is a dry red hulk, and very concrete proof that it used to be recently a water planet. Jupiter, the original star pair of the Sun. Now, this is very important. They have exactly the same atmospheric composition. Their axis of rotation is perfectly aligned. Everything about them shows that they are a pair. So Jupiter was not a planet, never has been a planet, and probably early in its life was a star, a lit star. And it's still producing fusion, something that Voyager confirmed. The proton wind that's coming off of Jupiter, directly measured by the Voyager spacecraft, actually published in Science magazine. Saturn acting the same, but Saturn being much more active regarding fusion. Actually, Saturn is smaller, and for some reason, possibly it's younger, more active, or possibly it is being fired by a stronger discharge of the solar capacitor out in the region of its orbit in the far reaches of the solar system. Okay, so then we go out to Neptune and Uranus being pulled down out of their orbits by some object. Harrington goes down to New Zealand by the influences of his assistant, Tom Van Flandern, and actually discovers the object that's pulling down on the orbits of Neptune and Uranus. As he's coming back, he dies. His work is never extended or made public. Tom Van Flandern, his assistant, goes on record as saying there's no such thing as Planet X, even though he's got the data in hand from Harrington showing that Harrington had discovered a Planet X-type object. Also that Van Flandern's own work was that there was an object, a planet between Mars and Jupiter, which was blown to smithereens by a rogue planet coming into the solar system, which you could only term as Planet X. Not that that's the same Planet X that we call Nibiru whatever, but another one of the many Planet X objects. I want to talk about the structure of stars a little bit. And this, of course, is in my work, but I just want to review that for this particular session because it's important to understand the nature of comets. They're the discharge of the solar capacitor. But what does this capacitor consist of? The Sun fusion at its surface, another theory that I had that I developed regarding the nature of fusion on the Sun, I had to show that the core fusion model was totally incorrect, and I've done that in 10 different ways, showing that the core fusion model cannot produce the amount of energy necessary to burn for the length of time of the solar system. And there's no way to get more material into the core. And so that's just one of the proofs that the core fusion model cannot possibly be correct, but also all of the surface activity and also the powering of the solar corona, the relativistic electrons that surround the sun, which standard astronomy cannot explain why that's there at all. But at any rate, the solar wind that comes off the sun has an excess current of positive charge. And so the excess current of charge is important because current is charge times velocity. So you have to understand that the protons come off the sun with a higher velocity. And we see this in proton storms and the solar storms that come off the sun are blasts of primarily protons that we are measuring. So the other issue is, how does this extend out and support the nebular ion cloud, which is a cloud of dust, ionized dust and gases, etc., out far beyond the orbit of Pluto. But I want to point out that, in fact, I have pictures of these in my books. Every star that we see out there, every active fusion star, has a surrounding nebular cloud associated with it. And that's what in our own solar system we call the Kuiper region. That's where NASA is discovering all of these planets, and they're developing out there. They have a very rich a reservoir of material to draw in to form the comets, which are discharging the solar capacitor out there and forming these planets. They have discovered literally thousands of planets, Pluto-sized planets and larger, out in that region, and they've only been searching a very small part of the sky. As I said before, you do not see the big, big objects, because typically they're surrounded by a dust cloud, a cloud of dust and gases, which, number one, blocks the sun from hitting them, illuminating the nucleus or these large objects. And second of all, you would only see them in the faint infrared, only just the heat signatures of these clouds moving around, so they're very difficult to detect. But this is somewhat the structure of the solar system. So we have the nine traditional planets from Mercury out to Pluto, and then beyond that, we have literally thousands of other planets. And really, Pluto is very much characteristic of the type of planets out in that region. The Pluto acting like a comet, like I predicted, and starting to wind its way into the solar system, probably going to take hundreds of millions, if not of years, or possibly longer, as it very slowly, the tail drag works it into the solar system. That's probably where Titan came from. It was a large comet in the outer solar system working its way in from the Kuiper Belt, eventually becoming captured by Saturn. And so Saturn would be a major collecting point. NASA has already confirmed that something like 27 of the moons of Saturn have to have been captured. They do not show any type of pattern relative to formation at the same time as Saturn, because of just by looking at their orbits. So capture is the way of the solar system. In comet capture processes in the formation of solar systems is the title of one of my early works in dealing with solar system formation. So anyway, what I'm saying is that Planet X objects in the form of comets is normal. That's the norm in the solar system. So and also the statistics of the size of objects tells us that the majority of comets are small. There are not many medium-sized ones of the size of Venus, which are moderately large. There are very few in comets of the size of Jupiter. The nucleus being the size of Jupiter are extremely rare. And so, but the other part of this is, let's look at biological development. If a planet formed and had no outside exterior influences, as it cooled, it would become round, it would not have an atmosphere, it would not have water, and it'd be perfectly round as a billiard ball, smooth as a baby's bottom, so to speak. And so how do you form mountains? Well, what standard science says is by plate tectonics. But where's the force that creates the movement of these plates? What makes a plate move sideways? Well, nobody seems to be able to explain that. Sure looks nice in those artist conceptions in a textbook, But when it comes down to really saying how the physics works, nobody out in that world can tell you. So the reality is that the planets, developing planets, have to have, number one, water, number two, an atmosphere, and number three, mountainous terrain, so that they would be so that they would have land and oceans, etc., for proper development of life. So the history of Earth is very complicated, and this is important also. We are finding water. We are finding water deposits. We're finding salt deposits. We're finding mineral deposits. We're finding oil thousands and thousands of feet under the surface of the Earth. Now, where did this come from? That means that the surface processes that we see today, the sodium comes from outer space. We know Earth sports a sodium tail, as does our moon, because that's the part of the solar system we're in that's rich in sodium. But the salt oceans are very important. They're a very important part of the development of life. And these oceans and other systems that are geologically developing life on this planet right now and sustaining life have happened in the past, and they're buried under thousands and thousands, up to 20,000 feet of Earth. So Earth is a very, very old planet. It's been around a long time. And the idea that our Earth is 4.5 billion years old, this number that people keep throwing out, is based on the age of surface rocks. So it turns out that possibly the surface of the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, but the Earth itself is maybe twice that old, in that the Earth had plentiful life in past lives, so to speak. And maybe these layers that are 18, 20,000 feet under the surface, what is now the surface of the Earth, were very rich, ecological, environmentally sound ecosystems on planet Earth in the distant past. That's very much likely the case. So the standard mechanism for violence in the universe, whether it's a forest fire, whether it's a hurricane, to stir up the pot, so to speak, to cause biological life to flourish and cause it to change, force it to change, is in the comets. They provide water, and Earth itself may have had a good deal of oxygen and hydrogen locked up. And, for example, like Venus right now, has a tremendous amount in sulfuric acid in the atmosphere and other compounds, carbon dioxide, very rich. When these finally break down in the end, you're going to have water. You're going to have other compounds in Venus, but they're in different chemical format right now as that violently hot planet cools down. I talk about this in my work. So the whole idea that comets come into the solar system, cause destruction, and then nestle into a planetary orbit is simply how the solar system works. So the idea of Planet X is simply normal. I mean, it is the way things work. It's like having a phobia over hurricanes. Hey, buddy, if you live down in the Atlantic or if you live in the Pacific along the equator, chances are you're going to get visited by a hurricane in your lifetime. If you live there forever, for your entire lifetime, yes, chances are you are going to be visited by a typhoon or hurricane. Likewise, if you live on planet Earth, or if you live on any planet in the universe, you're going to get visited someday by a large passing comet, and it's going to ruin your day. Let me put it that way. It's going to cause a lot of damage. Your house might not be there. Your civilization might not be there. It might do minor damage. It may cause a flood. It may cause severe weather. It may cause electrical discharges. It may cause mountain building, earthquakes, etc. But these, you have to understand, only occur when these objects become very close. There's all kinds of effects. So you have to divide between gravitational effects, which are very short range. You have to be extremely close. In other words, like the distance to our moon or closer or within two or three lunar distances for the gravitational effects. That includes the mountain building, the tsunamis, all of the other violent earth, the eruption of volcanoes, etc. Along with that, if the object is farther away, then you can get electrical conditions, violent weather, changing of the atmosphere, a pollution event where it removes atmosphere or drops chemicals, etc., into our atmosphere, a tremendous pollution event. There is evidence on planet Earth of at least a dozen major mass extinctions. That means that something major came by, and standard science always wants to blame this on colliding asteroids. Let me tell you something, that's the most overrated, overpublicized, and least effective way. If you want to destroy a civilization on a planet, a colliding asteroid is not the method of choice, because it's very localized. The computer simulations done by NASA to suggest that the entire Earth is going to burn up is completely false. Most of that energy is absorbed locally, and we see from large collisions of objects in the past, not only on Earth but on other planets, that in fact the damage is very localized, and a lot of the heat goes straight up. It doesn't go around the world. It is now evidence, and this is well-confirmed evidence, that the crater that's down off the Yucatan Peninsula that everybody's been trying to tout as the asteroid that destroyed the dinosaurs did not even destroy the local population of dinosaurs, let alone the entire world population of dinosaurs. So the idea of asteroids colliding into Earth, sure, that happens. Yes, it's a possibility. If one hits you on the head, hey, that's going to ruin your day. But it's probably the majority of the size asteroids they're dealing with now, the ones they're observing. And I'm not trying to make light of the idea of asteroids colliding into Earth. It's happened in the past. It's going to happen again. But the major mass extinctions are due to comet passages by Earth. These are the big comets, not the little Halley poofball comets that we see on a regular basis in the solar system. If Hale-Bopp would have come by Earth, let's say within a half of lunar distance, in other words, half the distance to the moon, we would have had major problems on planet Earth. Not to mention flooding, electrical conditions, weather, tidal waves, mountain building. If Hale-Bopp would have come a million miles away, that's four lunar distances away from Earth, we would have still had major effects, depending on the time we spent in the coma, the cloud part of the comet. And like I said before, if we would have passed through the tail, the big broad tail part of Hale-Bopp, we would have had 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain, which led me to say that there's a candidate. Hale-Bopp would be a candidate comet for the Noah's Flood. That doesn't say that was the comet, because there could be many, many, many other comets of which we don't have any history. In the first hour, I believe I started to enumerate the various types of Planet X objects, one being the object that comes in to the solar system or relative to the sun, comes near the sun, and actually comes towards the sun, the region around the sun, whips around the sun in its orbit, possibly interacts with some of the planets, possibly not. But it comes from completely away from the solar system. In other words, not related to our sun's gravitational field at all. And so could it be captured? Yes, it could be captured. It could become part of the solar system. It could flip around the sun and it's on its elliptical orbit and keep going, or a hyperbolic orbit, whatever it happens to be, parabolic orbit, and continue out and never come back. The second type of Planet X-type object, and these can be large, they can be small, or anything in between. The second type of Planet X-type object is the one that for a long time has been associated with our star, the Sun. It has potentially a large orbit, maybe 100,000 years, a million years. We have absolutely no record of these at all. We don't know when they might come back, or how big they are, or what direction they might come from, or how they got associated with our Sun in the first place. Were they part of the original solar system, or did they become adapted at a later time? We don't have any record of these at all. So like I say, if something came into the solar system and somebody goes, oh, that must be Planet X, how do you tell? How does anybody tell what this object was. You know, that this is somehow your planet X. Does it have a big neon sign? Hey, I'm Nibiru. Hi, over here. Everybody, welcome me back. No. You know, there's no way of knowing what these objects, putting a tag on them. The third type of Planet X type object is one that would be in a relatively close orbit around our solar system, potentially in the Kuiper Belt, because that's where a lot of planetary activity is. That's where a lot of the bigger Planet X type objects exist. But that doesn't mean those big ones will be the ones coming into the inner solar system. What it means is they will potentially toss some of the smaller ones in at us, and they will look like they're coming from a great distance, much farther than the solar system, and that gives the illusion that these objects are coming from something called the Oort cloud. The Oort cloud is a hypothetical region that's out a couple light years from our sun where comets allegedly formed. It's never been discovered physically. It never could be discovered physically with any stretch of the imagination of equipment that we now have or that we would ever have in the future. So, but astronomers rely on that because they can't explain where comets come from. Well, now I'm telling you, many comets would come from the Kuiper Belt, and comets are not dirty snowballs. They're simply other planetary objects. They could be small, they could be medium, they could be large. And so, at any rate, that's a third source of comets. And then the other comets are just debris, asteroids, etc., not related to the asteroid belt, but that have been potentially influenced by planets in the past. All of the planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, have families of comets. Halley's is a member of, I believe, the Jupiter family of comets. Comes back every 71 years. So obviously it was captured at one point in history in our solar system by Jupiter, and now it's a permanent member of the solar system, comes back about every 71 years. And this was one of the first major discoveries back in the Middle Ages, that Tycho and the crew back then realized that these comets came back on periodic cycles, and they could measure back into history and kind of get an idea that, hey, this is the same one. And then when it actually was came back to in the solar system where it was visible again, they were able to calculate using the new dynamics that was developed by the those fellows, those very intelligent scientists in the Middle Ages. And I wonder what they would say today if they saw the shenanigans going on with NASA and Tier 1 and hiding data and telling people that comets are dirty snowballs when they know, in fact, they're not. You know, what would those guys say? Well, they lived through it. Galileo died under house arrest. He was blind because of counting sunspots through his little telescope. He didn't realize you shouldn't be looking at the sun. But basically died under house arrest because they didn't want him talking about the solar system the way he viewed it, and which the solar system as we view it today and accept today. But at any rate, let's go back to comets. Comet capture, Planet X type objects appearing as comets, not as big orange balls up in the sky, is standard fare. It's as standard as a forest fire, as standard as a drought, as standard as floods, as any of the other earthquakes, volcanoes, any of the other natural disasters that could occur. And large ones are very rare, large comets, but they do happen. And when they do happen and come close, they can cause considerable damage. They can still cause effects on Earth, what I call action at a distance. They can discharge the solar capacitor, kick up the energy of the sun, which then causes Earth weather. And this is what a lot of people are referring to. And, of course, if you want to talk about somebody that really developed this entire topic, that was me. I'm the one that showed how the solar system works, the discharge of the solar capacitor, how it affects our weather, etc. But to simply willy-nilly say, hey, our weather looks like we're having a little foul weather today, must be Planet X, is not scientifically valid. That's hocus-pocus science, somebody trying to sell you a book. And so, it's, you know, that's going on all over the place. And people, like I say, they don't have any more correlation between a Planet X object and the price of refrigerators. But they will tell you all day because, hey, who's there to tell you that they're wrong? But they don't have any data. These things require data. When I developed my theoretical work, I didn't just willy-nilly say, oh, I wonder if comets could cause weather changes. No, I had to show how it happened. I had to show how the connection between comets and the sun and the solar wind and Earth weather and the discharge in Earth, the interaction of Earth with our local environment, all of these steps of the puzzle had to be put in place. I didn't just say, ah, there's more sunspots, that affects weather. That's stupid. That's not scientific. It doesn't, in fact, the number of sunspots, it's well known, has nothing to do with our weather. If you looked at the correlation between sunspots and our weather, there's no correlation at all. You bet, yet there's some yahoos out there that'll try and sell you a book based on that. Absolutely no foundation at all. So, science, like I said, has to be consistent, it has to be well-developed, it has to be based on rigorous information. And so if there's a Planet X object and it's affecting our weather, you have to be able to observe this. And the way you do that is with good equipment. That's part of the problem, too, is that NASA has good equipment, but they're hiding it from you and me. And so, but you still can't just simply go out there and say willy-nilly, we think Planet X is out in the far reaches of the solar system, and that's why we're having more tornadoes today. Doesn't cut it. It's not scientific. You need causal effect, relationship, data, information, and that's the problem with what's going on with the whole topic of Planet X today. People are out there tooting their horn and don't have any solid information. And that's why people listen to me, because I will only give you, if there's something going on and I see that and there are measurables, I will explain that to you. I will bring it down to Earth and I'll say, this is what's going on. We can see that. When we see the comets coming near the sun, there's a comet that approached the sun recently, about a year and a half ago, and I said this potentially could cause problems on Earth, because it's going to be a sun-diving comet, etc. And it turned out that there were no effects. So I came out and I said that. I said, this comet, as it passed around the sun and it came out the other side, I said, did not send any solar flares earthways. We had a couple of effects, but they were rather minor. And so I did talk about that. But basically, the big, what you might call the kill shot, did not happen. And you have to report things as they are. In making predictions, you have to make predictions with qualifications and say, this might happen, but you have to say, you know, what the probability is. Is this possible or is it not? And so, scientific evidence, scientific measurements, and then predictions. This is the problem with a lot of the what's going on with the public today. The scientific community is talking about global warming or global climate change. And what do? They stick a thermometer out the window at the airport where the temperature is always higher, and they say, hey, the temperature's gone up. Therefore, there must be global warming. You know, it's not scientific. Is there global warming? The answer is yes. It's because the Earth is warming up from a previous ice age. I've explained this in my weather book. So you have to understand what the reason is, what the cause, what the effect. And yes, we've lost glaciers. We've lost ice fields, in fact, but the actual climate of Earth many times is not even related to the temperature. I've given an example where you take two cardboard boxes or boxes, sealed boxes, and you put exactly the same amount of air, the same type of air, everything in both boxes. They're absolutely identical. And you measure their temperature, they're absolutely identical. Okay, now cause one of the boxes to become a little bit cooler, draw some heat out of it, put it in the refrigerator, whatever you want to do, but then add some water content to that box. It turns out that the amount of heat energy in that box is higher, even though the temperature is lower. And so this idea of global warming being interpreted as climate change, which is a temperature is not related to temperature, but is related to heat content, the scientists aren't doing their job. They're lazy. They're not They're not taking the measurements, and to actually talk about true climate change would be a much more rigorous set of experiments and data that it would have to include the concentration of heat in the oceans. It would have to cause the surface temperature of the Earth down to a few meters. They're not taking any of this data. And so how can they possibly talk about climate change when, in fact, they're not making climate measurements? They're only taking temperature changes, and most of that data is fudged. So this is what I mean. If you're going to do science, do science. If you're going to be an armchair scientist and sit there and say Planet X is here and some kind of conclusion, well, you know, in my ballpark, you're not going to play ball. You're going to be put out in the outside, and you're not going to be allowed to play ball because you're not doing real science. You're just blowing your horn, and it really has nothing to do with any real science. So, once again, comets in the solar system, big comets are rare. Are they going to affect Earth? Yes. Have they done it in the past? Yes. Are they going to do it in the future? Yes. Can I tell you tonight when that's going to happen again? No, I can't. And I'm not going to make a prediction unless I have real data. Is there something coming in the south after Hale-Bopp, the object that Harrington saw as Planet X? As far as I can see in my own personal study that it is equipment equivalent to what Harrington was using, there's nothing coming in right now. But with better equipment, infrared telescopes, larger telescopes, larger visible telescopes, or satellite-based telescopes, someone might be able to see something and they're hiding data from you. I can't say. All I can tell you is what data I have. Much of scientific evidence is based on a certain measurement, a level of measurement. And you give that, and that's part of the scientific result. Whether you're looking for pi muons or whether you're looking for the new God particle or whatever you're looking for, when you do an experiment, not only do you search for that, but you have to give the level, the significance or level of accuracy of your experiment so that the next person that comes along can say, well, it's already been tested out to this level. Other equipment might test out to an extended level. That's part of it. So right now, NASA is involved in a search for Planet X-type objects. They've already admitted this. They've already admitted they found two large Planet X objects. But when you say Planet X, that doesn't mean it's coming into the solar system and going to cremate Earth. That doesn't mean that at all. It's simply an object. It's out there, and it's in an orbit. And they're not releasing the orbital data, but chances are very slim, if zero chance, that any of these are going to ever have any effect on Earth at all. But what they can do is interact with other objects, toss them around, and then as this billiards game, this celestial billiard game of chance begins, these objects start getting tossed around the solar system. Eventually, they might come into Earth on an advanced schedule, on a much earlier schedule than if they were simply out there by themselves. So you can see this is a very complicated topic. And even if you had a lot of data, you might not be able to predict. Look at it, Hale-Bopp. They thought that was on a collision course with Earth when they first discovered it. It missed us by 3 months. Actually, we were more than that. We were more than 3 months in our orbit when Hale-Bopp came and crossed the ecliptic plane about 1 million miles from where Earth would have been if that's where Earth would have been. I said before that the original planned date, as close as I could figure it, was Christmas Day 1997 for the closest approach of the comet Hale-Bopp to Earth. That was based on its very original orbit. So you can imagine the fear, the loathing, the amount of hiding of data, the capping of scientists, what happened within NASA and the scientific community, then what happened as Hale-Bopp was publicly discovered as it exploded into brightness. They were watching that baby like a hawk in the public reaction. They had meetings in the 4 years prior to that. They knew eventually it would be discovered. What were they going to say about it? They already had the Nancy Leader, Crazy Lady Talks to Alien, disinformation program in place saying, don't look at that. That's just a figment of your imagination over there. They had NASA saying, don't look at that. It's just a little snowball. They had so much misinformation stuck out in your face that you couldn't even believe it. And here we are, 2015. The story is finally coming out. But look at the point is, look at how far off the schedule Hale-Bopp was. It was a complete 3 month plus difference from the original planned orbit. So can you predict where things are going to be? No. Can you estimate where things are going to be? No. Hale-Bopp also had an interaction with Jupiter. And as its orbit was changing before it got to Jupiter, how are you going to tell, because you don't really know how its orbit is going to change, so how are you going to tell what the real interaction with Jupiter is going to be? You can't. Do you see how complicated this problem is? So not even with supercomputers, the best information, can somebody tell you what the orbit, or that simple question that everybody asks, when is planet X going to be here? It's a non-question. It doesn't even make any sense when you understand the real parameters here. When you understand what's really going on, you cannot answer that question. You can't answer how these things are going to interact with other planets or the sun. It's very difficult. There's some certain parameters that you could talk about, that it's going to interact with the sun. Can you guarantee that the solar flares come from that interaction are going to come at Earth? No. Can you guarantee that it's going to go at Jupiter or Mars or Venus or Mercury? No, not at all. These are almost governed by chance. If we had infinite data about the solar system, about the fusion process in the sun, we might come close to being able to make these kind of predictions. But that's far in the future and certainly far out of the scope of the information that's available today, partly also due to the mismanagement at NASA, and also the division of Tier 2 science. You got to believe that the Tier 1 scientists have been to Mars with robotics, certainly much better than a couple little rovers. They've been examining the existence of life up there, possibly the remnants of civilizations that were actually living on Mars before it lost its atmosphere. Yeah, that's all Tier 1 science, things that you will never see. Because you're in the public, you get to see NASA and these buffoons running around pretending like they know something, putting out a couple pretty pictures of Pluto or whatever the latest visitation was, giving you bad interpretation of data, pretending like they're experts and spending the next 10 years mulling over it and not really presenting information. This is the state of so-called science today. So if you look in the past, Earth has had a very rugged past. At least a dozen very major mass extinctions that have brought the Earth back to literally the cell level, or almost at the cell level, and change of atmosphere, very drastic changes, either added atmosphere or removed atmosphere, only to have Earth build it up again. We see Mars building up its atmosphere today, rebuilding, and eventually will be a water planet again someday. It's expanded its atmosphere greatly when comet sighting Spring passed Mars recently. They saw a large increase in the atmosphere of Mars and also specific elements that had to have been brought in by the comet. There's no question that everything I've been telling you is 100% correct. I'm now convinced about this entire issue of Hale-Bopp. And when you put it into perspective, you start to see, like I say, all the human drama that occurred regarding the topic of Hale-Bopp and Planet X, it all starts to make sense. Once you realize that what Harrington saw, 1991, what he came back, his hands full of data from his 8-inch astrograph in New Zealand, he had seen the nucleus of what we eventually called Hale-Bopp. And that's what they were calling Planet X. Very important announcement, very important piece of data fitting into this history. And now you know the whole story. Hopefully you won't be fooled by other people talking about the topic of Planet X. We do have to be very vigilant in this whole topic of Planet X, because it will, in the future, there will be Planet X objects. There will be things that we have to be concerned about. But right now, the biggest thing we have to be concerned about is the leaders of the world, this craziness that's going on, and try and dump these, I won't go into that. You all know what I'm talking about. And if there's an event, some kind of celestial event that's real, I will announce it. I'll get the information, verify it, and I will announce it. But I can't continue using my time. This is a tremendous amount of time I'm spending on this Hale-Bopp Planet X update to give you real information. And so my venue in the future will be, if there is real information, it will come to me, it'll get in my hands, and I will examine it. And if there is something real, I will tell you. That's not to say all the information in Tier 1 science will come to me. So there's a good chance that you won't have any information or warning because it's all being harbored by the Tier 1 scientists and the world bankers, etc., who don't want you to know what's going on. But as a public, you can be prepared, and as well prepared as you can possibly be. And if you're prepared and living your preparedness, then you will be a very happy person, and you won't even be asking the question, when is Planet X going to be here, because you will be prepared as best you can. This is Jim McCanney. I hope you enjoyed this series. And when I do these series, it's for all time. It's not for, this year or 2015. This is something that in 10 or 15 or 100 years, people can listen to and gain the understanding of this topic. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.